Chapter 7. "No, no. Keep your sword and give me your hand," I said. And perhaps that may sound rather like Drury Lane when the fellow in pink breeches and a plumed helmet raises his fallen enemy and the stillroom maid is found to be the Duke's daughter, but at the time I do assure you it came quite natural. I was so very glad to see him. If you've had the long letter that Raffles promised to put aboard the next engineman, you'll know who I mean. Jean-Pierre Dumesnil, the nephew of that Captain Christipalière who captured me when I had the Sophie and who treated me so well. The nephew I met in Poulo-Prebang, changed from a little fat midshipman to a tall, thin young officer, second of the Cornélie. I thought him a fine young fellow then, and I think him an even finer fellow now. I beg you look in the bottom right-hand drawer of the black scrutoire and find the direction of his Christie cousins. I think they live in Milsom Street. He went to Dr. Hall's school in Bath during the peace, and he often stayed with them. Desires his duty and most affectionate greetings, and you'll tell them he's quite unhurt. During the engagement, one of our 32-pounders played Old Harry on the Cornélie's quarterdeck, leaving Jean-Pierre in command, and another caused her to spring a butt low down in her bows. She made so much water that pumping day and night they could only just keep her free, even with a following wind. Yet for all that, and in spite of being short-handed, he fought his ship nobly. He might even have had us if we hadn't met the surprise in the mouth of the passage with four ships in company. Tom Pullings had heard the sound of gunfire long before daylight and had come tearing down from his station well to the north. The four came into sight round a headland first, wearing American colours, and I said, "Why, Jack, you're between the devil and the deep blue sea." Meaning the Cornélie's devilish 18-pounders behind me and the concentrated fire of an American squadron in front and no sea room to manoeuvre. But then I saw the dear surprise appear. Lord, what joy! And I threw out the signal to chase to the northwest. Clearly, five against one wasn't fair odds, so Jean-Pierre hauled his wind in the hope of getting away behind one of the islands to the south under cover of a squall. But his people had scarcely been able to keep pace with the leak, even when they had the wind well abaft the beam. And now, with a head sea and all hands utterly exhausted, she could no longer swim. He just had time to get his boats clear before she settled. The surprise recovered them. Some could barely stand and had to be hauled aboard in slings. And when the nutmeg came up and I went across, he surrendered to me. Then, the passage being but an uneasy place to lie in, we proceeded eastwards to this sheltered road, anchored in 60-fathom water, and made acquaintance with the other ships. The Triton is a heavy letter of mark, almost as large as the Surprise. She's commanded by Horseflesh Goffin, who's court-martial for a false muster, you'll probably remember, and they'd been cruising together for some time. The others were splendid American prizes they'd taken, all the more splendid because they contained the cargoes of several other vessels too small to be worth a prize crew. One of them's crammed with furs, sea otter and the like, much demanded in China where both ships were bound. Upon the whole, the Surprise seems to have had an unusually successful cruise even before these two big merchantmen, capturing Nantucket and New Bedford whalers and sending them into South American ports, but I don't know exactly. We have so much to say to one another, and there's so much to do in the poor battered nutmeg that I don't know half what there is to know. He was sitting at the starboard extremity of the line of sashlights that filled the great cabin with sunshine reflected from a dappled sea, a window that was more familiar to him than any he'd known on land. And looking out, he saw the nutmeg, trim again after a surprisingly short stay in this road, with the carpenter and his crew over the side putting the last touches to the stern gallery. He glanced along the table to the other end of the range. But seeing that Stephen was writing busily with a contentious look on his face, he let his gaze wander over the table itself, which had been set quite exceptionally in the great cabin, to seat 14 men in comfort. And he saw, not without a certain complacency, that it was set with uncommon magnificence. This was the sort of occasion that Killick loved more than his soul, and Jack Silver, preserved through all the vicissitudes of the voyage, blazed and twinkled in the shifting light. Stephen scratched steadily on, though now his look was more benign as he wrote, "And so, having demolished Baker on the economy of the solitary bee, I shall only add that I am heartily tired of being a solitary bee myself. I have no words to express my longing to hear from you again, to learn that you and perhaps our daughter are recovered well and happy. And so far as material things affect happiness, it may increase yours, as it has increased mine, to know that if these prizes reach port, our economy may be somewhat less sparse, pinched, anxious, grey." Jack returned to his letter. "Yet Surprise's share of these two merchantmen alone should be something of a relief to poor Stephen, as owner and fitter out he has the largest share, of course. Something of a relief, I say. But I'm afraid it can go only a very little way towards recovering his fortunes. I'm not sure how they stand, because although as soon as I heard of the bank being broke, I hurried to his room and said that I had never regretted anything in my life, so much as my advice to move to Smith and Close, that I hoped and prayed he'd not followed it to a disastrous extent, and I had meant to go on to say that we'd shared purses before and must certainly do so again. But I stumbled over my words. I'd already put it badly, and he pulled me up. 'No, no, not at all. It was no great matter. I'm infinitely obliged to you.' Since then, he said nothing. And although from time to time I've thrown out what I hope were delicate hints and suggestions, he's not seemed to notice them. And with a man Lucifer couldn't hold a book, bell or candle to for pride, I cannot raise the subject directly. But, however, when this voyage is over, I shall beg him as a favour to sell me the Surprise. Not only would it give me extraordinary pleasure, but it would at least serve to keep him afloat. To go back to the other ships. The Americans are rather thinly manned, many of their people having been set ashore in Peru, it being so much wiser to put it out of their power to rise upon you and recapture the ship. But there's little risk of that, since they'll be escorted not only by the Triton, which is a powerful ship for these waters and full of hands, but by the Nutmeg too. It'll be quicker for her to return to Batavia by way of Canton. They're waiting for the northeast monsoon. Quicker than beating back into the teeth of this one. I offered Tom the command, but he said he'd rather stay with us. So Fielding has her, and very highly delighted he is." Killick came in, and stood breathing heavily in the doorway and looking disagreeable. They took no notice, intent upon their letters. He came forward to the table and moved some knives and forks quite unnecessarily and with unnecessary noise. "Get out, Killick," said Jack, without looking round. "Killick, you break in upon my thoughts," said Stephen. "Which I only came to say. The cook has burnt the soup, the doctor ain't shaved yet, and your honour's spilt ink on your breeches, your only decent breeches." "God's blood, hell and death, so I have," cried Jack. "Go and rouse out my second best. Stephen, we may poach upon your comforts, may we not? Killick, go and ask Mr. Martin, with the doctor's compliments, for 3 slabs of portable soup." "3 slabs of portable soup, it is, sir," said Killick, adding, "It won't be nearly enough, though, not nearly enough," as it were to himself. Jack returned to his letter. "My dear, we are to have a farewell dinner in 30 minutes. There's plenty of time, but I know that all hands concerned are anxious for its success, the more so in that Nutmeg is a regular man-of-war with a pennant, and led by Killick they'll come in on one pretext or another, or peer through the companion, glooming and coughing at us until we're up there, square-rigged and spotless, to welcome our guests." He'd finished the letter with love and kisses all round when the door opened for Tom Pullings. Now, acting as the frigate's first lieutenant again, in spite of which he was wearing the uniform of his rank as commander. A splendid uniform, though somewhat creased and smelling of tropical mould, not having been put on for the last 9,000 miles. "Forgive me, sir," he said, "but you didn't hear me knock, and I believe a boat is putting off from Triton." "Thank you, Tom," said Jack. "I shall just seal this letter, and then I'm with you. And, sir, I'm very much ashamed to say that when you first came aboard, I quite forgot to give you a letter handed to me at Callao. It was in the pocket of this here coat, and it flew clean out of my mind till I heard it crinkle." Jack instantly perceived that the letter was from his natural son, begotten when he was on the Cape Station in his youth, and he scarcely heard Pulling's confused account of a clergyman that had visited the surprise when she put in, had been deeply disappointed at finding that Captain Aubrey wasn't aboard, nor Dr. Maturin, spoke perfect English, only with a sort of brogue. You would have said he was an Irishman, only he was black, cold black. Tom had met him again at the governor's, where he stood next to the bishop, dressed in a purple frock and treated with great respect. It was there that he'd given Tom this letter. Renewed apologies, retreat. A letter from Sam, said Jack, passing the first sheet. How well he expresses himself. A very happy turn of phrase, upon my word. There's a message for you, passing the second, and something in Greek. Pray read it all. How he's coming on, to be sure. He will soon be Vicar General at this rate. It's not Greek, but Irish. And referring to my intervention with the Patriarch, it says, may God set a flower upon your head. Come, that is civil. I can hardly put it better myself. So the Irish have a writing of their own? I'd no idea. Certainly they have a writing of their own. They had it long before your ancestors left their dim Teutonic wood. And indeed it was the Irish first taught the English the ABC, though with indifferent success, I freely admit. Yet this is a very handsome letter, so it is. Now, sir, said Killick, a razor in his hand, a towel over his arm, the water's getting cold. He's the dearest fellow, said Jack to himself, reading Sam's letter through once more. But how glad I am it came when mine was done. Sam's existence was perfectly well known and accepted in Ashgrove Cottage. It was perfectly well known and a source of much amusement aboard the Surprise, many of whose older hands had seen the young man first come aboard, his father's image, though shining black. But Jack Aubrey's mind, though logical in mathematics and celestial navigation, he'd read several papers to the Royal Society with great applause on the part of those fellows who understood them, gloomy fortitude on the part of the rest, was less so where laws were concerned. Some, and almost all of those to do with the service, he obeyed without question. Others, he transgressed at times and then suffered in his conscience. Others, again, he laughed at. Sam's place in this shifting landscape was obscure. Jack couldn't feel any easily defined guilt at that remote fornication, and he heartily loved his black popish priest of a boy. But a contradiction still remained, and it would have made him profoundly uneasy to read a letter from Sam while he was himself writing to Sophie. The letter itself was perfect. Between the "My dear sir" and "Your most humble, obedient and affectionate servant," it spoke of Sam's pleasure at seeing the ship, his disappointment at not being able to pay his respects to Captain Aubrey and Dr. Maturin, of his journey across the Andes, of the great kindness of the bishop, an ancient gentleman from old Castile. Everything was entirely discreet. Anyone could have read it. Yet the whole breathed affection. And Jack had returned to the beginning still again when Killick wiped the smile off his face with the news that the Nutmeg, too, had lowered down a boat. In point of fact, neither this nor the Tritons was coming to the Surprise. They had quite different tasks. And the foolish anxiety on the part of the frigate's people meant that Jack stood on the quarterdeck, hot in his best clothes in spite of the awning, for what seemed a very long and hungry waste of time. The group to leeward, Pullings, Davidge, West and Martin, the first, second, third lieutenants and the assistant surgeon, found the waiting equally hot and even hungrier. Hot because, although only Pullings was in uniform, West and Davidge, dismissed from the Navy, had no right to it, nor had Martin, though for different reasons. The others were dressed in formal clothes. And they, too, regretted their coats, waistcoats, high-tight neckcloths, leather shoes. Hungrier because they had reverted to the old-fashioned dinner at Two Bells, Pullings messing with the gunroom rather than in solitary state. And that was now an hour and a half ago. Presently Martin's lot improved, for Stephen came up severely buttoned, shaved and brushed, and they fell into a most animated conversation in a neutral zone abaft the capstan, just not encroaching on the captain's holy windward solitude, and the immense amount of information each had to convey abolished all thought of food. This was a comfort denied the lieutenants. Their minds ran on their dinner. Their stomachs rumbled, they swallowed from time to time, but they said little. So little that Mr. Bulkley, the boatswain, could be heard in the waist, quietly reproving one of his mates for being barefoot. What will the gentlemen think of us when they come up the side? This would be in the very near future, for now the real boats had shoved off, and Killick and his mates were on their way with trays of glasses, bottles, frittoons, and what other delicacies the surprise could afford. Killick, they called, not very loud. But Killick affected not to hear, and pursing his lips he posed the trays on the gleaming capstan head, everything arranged just so, the pieces of bacon rind neatly crossed, nothing to be touched until the feast began. "Stand by," cried the boatswain, and poised his call. "Side men away," called West, the officer of the watch, as the first boat hooked on, and the guests were piped aboard. The first was Goffin, a tall, burly, black-haired man with a red face, a post-captain who had been cashiered, though he still wore the naval uniform with trifling changes. He saluted the quarter-deck. All the officers returned the salute. He said, "How do you do, Aubrey?" without a smile, and turned straight to Killick and the capstan. His nephew followed him, somewhat more gracious. Then came the people from the Nutmeg with the two surviving French officers, and finally Adams, accompanied by Reed and Oakes, for whom Jack felt a particular responsibility and who were to remain in the frigate, though they, having dined at noon, couldn't reasonably hope to dine again. When all the officers had taken their whet, which was limited to gin, Hollands and Plymouth, and Madeira, Jack led them below. As they trooped in, crowding the great cabin, Goffin called out, "By God, Aubrey, you do yourself proud." Then he moved towards the head of the table with its splendid array. "Here, sir, if you please, opposite your young gentleman," said white-gloved Killick, showing him a place at the other end next to Pullings. He swelled. His face went a darker red, and he sat down. It was impossible to fault the arrangement. By immemorial convention, the captured French officers sat on Jack's right and left, and the King's officers took place of those who were not or who were no longer King's officers. If this had been a small informal gathering, and if Goffin had been a friend, Jack might have ordered things differently. But then again, he might not. When he'd been struck off the list himself, when he had been in Goffin's uncomfortable position, well-meaning but thick-headed friends had sometimes given him the precedence due to his former rank. And he could feel the misery yet. Goffin, however, saw the matter in another light. He felt that his condemnation for the trifling offence of false muster was so merely technical. He'd entered the name of a friend's son on his ship's books to win the wholly absent boy some years of service time when he should in fact go to sea, a common practice but illegal, that his clerk, repeatedly kicked and cuffed, betrayed him, that he deserved better treatment. He sat for some time, trying to work out some remark that, though offensive, shouldn't be too gross. He had a perfectly good opportunity with the soup, which smelt so like a glue factory that the two Frenchmen put down their spoons before exchanging a haggard look and submitting to the horrors of war, while Pullings, for the honour of the ship, called to Stephen, "Very good soup, Doctor." And Jack said quietly to his neighbour, "I'm so sorry, Jean-Pierre, it was a desperate measure. Please tell your friend not to finish it." But Goffin missed his chance. Soups were all one to him. He ate it mechanically and passed his plate for more. And only when the plate was empty did he say to his nephew on the other side of the table, an elderly young gentleman who had failed to pass for lieutenant, "Was you ever at the Lord Mayor's banquet, Art?" "No, sir." "Or any of the city halls, grocers, fishmongers and the like? This is the sort of show you see among the commercial gents." The shaft missed its mark because Jack was laughing in his own deeply amused, full-throated way at one of his own jokes. But this, and various other jets of malignance, were perceived by those at the lower end of the table, and it didn't take long for Jack to become aware of their uneasiness. He guessed its source when he saw that dark face down there at Pulling's right, and he was certain of it a moment later. In a pause, Fielding had just said, "Speaking of bear, sir, did I ever tell you that my father was a midshipman in the racehorse under Lord Mulgrave? Or Captain Phipps, as he was then, in his voyage towards the North Pole? He wasn't exactly shipmates with Nelson, who was in the carcass, but they saw a great deal of one another ashore, and they got along together famously. Nelson?"
"You mustn't talk about Nelson with two French officers in company," cried Horseflesh. "It ain't civil."
"Oh, never mind us, sir," replied Jean-Pierre with a laugh. "Our withers are unwrung. We have Du Guay-Trouin, to name but one."
"Du Guay-Trouin? I never heard of him."
"Then you have a treat in store," said Jean-Pierre. "A glass of wine with you, sir."
"A glass of wine all round," said Jack. "Bumpers now, gentlemen, and no heel taps. To Du Guay-Trouin, and may we never meet his like."
After this, at Stephen's suggestion, they drank to Jean Bart, too. Killick and his mates ran in and out. The heap of empty bottles rose high in the steerage. An array of far more creditable dishes covered the table. And Jack said, "Pray, Mr. Fielding, go on with your account. It wasn't Nelson's famous attempt at a bear's skin, I collect."
"Oh, no, sir. In fact, it's not much of a story at all, except when my father tells it. But I'll just give the bare bones to show there's another side to the creature."
"Bare bones is very good," said Welby, chuckling into his wine glass. The ships were coming back from about 81 north. They'd been very nearly frozen in, and after prodigious exertions they were lying in Smeerenberg Bay in Spitsbergen. Most of the people were allowed ashore, some played leapfrog or football with a bladder, and some ran about the country in hope of game. Those who kept to the shore killed a walrus, an enormous creature, as I'm sure you know, sir. They stripped off the blubber, ate what a whaler in the company told them was the best part, cooking it over the blubber, which burns pretty well once the fire has a hold. Then, some time later, a day or so later, I think my father said, three white bears were seen coming over the ice, a she-bear and her cubs. The blubber was still burning, but the she-bear plucked out some pieces that were not alight and that had some flesh on them. They ate voraciously, and some of the seamen threw lumps from the carcass they still had towards her. She fetched them one by one, carrying them back to the cubs, and divided them. As she was fetching away the last piece, the men shot the cubs dead and wounded her severely as she ran. She crawled as far as the cubs, still carrying the piece, tore it apart, and laid some before each. And when she saw they couldn't eat, she laid her paws first upon one, then upon the other, and tried to raise them up. When she found she couldn't stir them, she went off. And when she'd got at some distance, looked back and moaned. And since that didn't induce them to come away, she returned, and smelling round them, began to lick their wounds. She went off a second time, as before, and having crawled a few paces, looked again behind her, and for some time stood there moaning. But her cubs still not rising to follow her, she returned to them again, and with signs of inexpressible fondness went round one and round the other, pawing them and moaning. Finding at last that they were cold and lifeless, she lifted her head towards the men and growled, and several firing together they killed her too. A decent silence. And Stephen said in a low voice, "Lord Mulgrave was the most amiable of commanders. He it was that first described the ivory gull, and he took particular notice of the northern jellyfish or blubbers." One bell in the first dog watch. The conversation had grown more general again, a steady hum of talk at the upper end, and Welby, his face now matching his scarlet coat,
had engaged the Cornelius monoglot third lieutenant in a far more confident and comprehensible French than any of his shipmates had expected, when, from the glum far end, came Goffin's voice, loud, somewhat out of control. "Well, seeing that many of us are out of favour in Whitehall, I'll give you a toast. Here's to the Navy's black sheep, and may they all soon be whitewashed with the same brush." They took it remarkably well. Both West and Davidge contrived a smile, and they all drank their wine and drew on every reserve of anecdote or remark about tide, weather, current, anything to prevent a silence. Welby coming out unusually strong with an account of the Pentland Firth, and Martin and Macmillan keeping up a fine flow on the subject of scurvy, its cure and prevention. But it was a relief when, after pudding, a noble great spotted dog and the best dish of the meal, they heard Jack say, "Doctor, please will you explain to your neighbour that we are just about to drink His Majesty's health, that it will be perfectly in order for him not to join us, but if he should choose to do so, we are privileged to drink it seated." The Cornelius third lieutenant did so choose. So did Jean-Pierre, who even added the words, "God bless him." And shortly after this, Jack suggested that they should take their coffee on the quarterdeck. Coffee, no great amount of brandy, and then farewells, obscurely righteous and indignant on Goffin's part, most affectionate upon that of the Nutmegs, who were to carry a whole sheaf of letters to Canton, and loving upon Jean-Pierre's. "I'm afraid that was a most unsuccessful dinner," said Jack, as they stood watching the boats pull away, horseflesh being sick over the side. "They're delicate things. I've noticed again and again that in parties of this kind, one man can wreck it all." "He's a gross fellow," said Stephen. "He cannot hold his wine." "He's losing it now, by God," said Jack. "Tell me, do our invalids really have to eat that dreadful soup? It was mixed four times too strong, and then was attempted to be disguised with some of the original broth itself, made of decayed swine's flesh in the first place, and then burnt. But it's not the soup that's making him vomit so, it's the black collar." "Ah, I'm sure you're right. Perhaps I should have made the invitation easier to refuse. When I was in his case, I dare say I wrecked many a party with my gloom before I learnt to have previous engagements. It's hardly to be believed how important a man's rank becomes to him. I mean, his place in our world, our wooden world, after he's served 20 years or so. And its order, laws, customs, and, God help us, even clothes have grown second nature. And poor horse flesh. Lord, how he pukes. Must have served nearer 30. He was second of the Bellerophon in 93 when I took passage in her, and he stood 5 places above me on the post-captain's list. Yet he broke one of its laws. Ah, yes, false muster. But, I mean, it's important laws, instant obedience, high discipline, exact punctuality, cleanliness and so on. I always thought them of the first importance, and now that I'm back, I thank God for it every day, I have still more respect for them, and even for the lesser rules too. Discipline is all of a piece, said St. Vincent, and I don't think I could bring myself to put anyone's name on the books. Unless, indeed, your daughter should prove a son with a taste for the sea. Captain Pullings, I believe you have something to say.
Yes, sir, if I may be so bold. When we've won our anchor and parted company, the people would take it kindly, was you to go round the ship.
That's exactly what I have in mind, Tom. Quarters, though without a clear run fore and aft, as soon as we're underway, and then I go round.
Yes, sir. Just so, sir. But what I mean is, in square rig. They haven't seen a gold-laced coat except for mine, and that only twice since Lisbon, which don't really signify, me being only a volunteer.
Jack was much attached to the crew of the Surprise, a difficult but highly seaman-like body made up of men-of-war's men and privateers, with a sprinkling of merchant seamen, and they were much attached to him. Not only had he done them exceedingly proud in the article of prizes when the Surprise sailed as a letter of marque, but he'd won them protection from impressment. and although in the course of the present voyage he'd been snatched away at Lisbon to command another ship, he had also been very publicly restored to the Navy List. So now he returned in the gold-laced splendour of a post-captain, conferring a delightful respectability on the frigate and her people. Privateering ships had a shocking reputation upon the whole. In fact, some were hardly to be distinguished from pirates, and the privateer's men aboard rejoiced in their new status, their freedom from criticism, and they loved to see the massive symbol of it, with the Nile medal in his buttonhole and his number one scraper on his head. The general feeling aboard was that the Surprises now had the best of both worlds. The relative freedom and equality of a letter of marque on the one hand, and on the other the honour and glory of the King's service. A charming state of affairs, particularly when it was coupled with the possibility of very great rewards. But so far their captain had scarcely made his official entrance. From far over the water came the sound of bosun's calls as the Prizes and their guardians prepared to ship capstan bars.
"Very well, Tom," said Jack, "but this coat's killing me. I shall go below, take it off, and see whether I can grow a little cooler. When you and the other officers have shifted into nankeens, let's get underway. Then I'll ask the people how they do. Doctor, will you come with me? Don't you feel the heat?"
"I do not," said Stephen. "Sobriety and moderation preserve me from plethory. They preserve me from discomfort in what is, after all, but a modest warmth.
Sobriety and moderation are capital virtues, and I've practised them from my earliest youth," said Jack, "but they're sadly out of place in a host who must encourage his guests to eat and drink by example. So there's a Roland for your..."
In his shirt sleeves and stretched out on the locker by the open stern windows, Jack loosened his waistband and reflected for a while. The name Oliver floated up out of a score of others. And he called, "Killick! Killick there!"
"What now?"
cried Killick, also in his shirt sleeves. He'd worked exceedingly hard to clear the table, and he was not pleased at being torn from his enormous washing up. Far too delicate to be trusted to seamen who would use brick dust on plate the minute they were left unwatched.
"Roland and Oliver. Have you ever heard of them?" "There is a Roland Sir Gunsmith off the Haymarket, and there's Oliver's warranted Leadenhall sausages. Many an Oliver's warranted Leadenhall sausage have I ate at the Grapes when we was ashore."
"Well," said Jack, unconvinced, "I may drop off. If I do, give me a call when we're underway." He heard the pipe, "All hands unmoor ship," followed by its invariable sequence. The muffled thunder of running feet, orders, pipes, the steady click of pawls, the stamp and go of those manning the bars, and the shrill fife on the capstan head. And his mind tried to recapture the exact state of the ship's company, her complete book, as it stood when he left her in Portugal. But so much had happened since then, and he'd eaten and drunk so heartily at dinner that his mind refused its duty, and at the distant cry of "thick and dry for weighing," he went to sleep. During the extraordinarily active period that had followed dropping anchor in this road, with the repairing of the Nutmeg, the disposal of the French prisoners, the inspection of the Prizes, the transfer of his and Stephen's possessions to the Surprise, and his farewell to his former shipmates, who cheered him in the kindest way when he went down the side for the last time, in these hours of continual running about, he had, of course, seen the Surprises, but only in a fleeting way, exchanging very few words except with his bargemen who pulled him from ship to ship in the warm, calm sea. He slept. But his sleep was pervaded by an anxiety. Few things wounded a foremast Jack more than having his name forgotten. And it was an officer's duty to remember it. In fact, it was not Killick who woke him, but Reed. "Mr. West's duty, sir, a Nutmeg has hoisted permission to part company." "Reply with affirmative and add Merry Christmas. You'll have to telegraph that. Where were we?" We've just catted the best bower, sir, and we were just about to fish it when a man called Davis fell overboard. Mr. West passed him a line and they hauled him aboard not a minute ago, much scraped. Jack was on the point of saying, then they can heave him back again. But Reed was much caressed by everyone aboard. In the Nutmeg, grim old forecastle hands would run the length of the gangway to hand him up a ladder, and it promised to be much the same in the Surprise. And he had a certain tendency to be above himself. This wasn't to be encouraged, and the remark changed to a dismissive, "Thank you, Mr. Reed." But the feeling behind it remained. Davis was a very large, dark, hairy man, dangerously savage, clumsy. His shipboard name of Awkward Davis arose from both these qualities. And so devoid of nautical skill that he was always quartered in the waist, where his enormous strength was of some use in hoisting. Jack had once saved him from drowning, as he'd saved many a man, being a capital hand at swimming. And the grateful Davis had persecuted him ever since, following him from ship to ship, impossible to shake off, though he'd been offered every opportunity of deserting in ports where merchantmen were offering wages far above the Navy's £1.5 and £1.6 a month. A disaster of a man. Violent, and quite capable of maiming or even killing a valuable hand out of jealousy or an imagined slight. But half a glass later, Jack found himself shaking Davies's hand with real pleasure. A terrible grip, followed by others almost equally powerful. For though the Surprises were pleased to see their captain in his full naval glory once more, his white silk stockings, his 100-guinea presentation sword, and the Turkish chelenk in his hat intimidated them a little, and although his progress was remarkably talkative for a king's ship, it was restrained for a privateer. So the seamen put nearly all their welcome into their handshake. Fortunately, Jack, too, had enormous hands, quite as strong, if not quite as horny. And fortunately, the Surprise, having left England ostensibly as a private ship of war, was much less heavily manned than a king's ship. Apart from anything else, she carried no marines. And there were not many more than 100 hands to shake. As for the names which had so worried him, they came without the slightest difficulty. Of course, it was easy enough with very old shipmates like Joe Place, who had sailed with him in many a commission. "Well, Joe, how are you coming along? How's the headpiece?" "Prime, sir, I thank you kindly," said Joe, tapping the silver dome that Dr. Maturin had screwed onto his damaged skull in 49 degrees south a great while ago. "And I give you all the joy in the world with them two swabs," winking at the crowned epaulettes that Jack had never worn until his reinstatement appeared in the London Gazette. But it was much the same with the other hands he'd taken on at Shelmiston, privateers or smugglers to a man. Harvey, Wall, Curtis, Fisher, Waits, Halkett, he said to the next gun crew, standing about their charge, old willful murder, in easy, informal attitudes. "How do you do?" And shook hands all round. And so it went, until he reached sudden death. And there he was very nearly brought up, all standing, by 6 profoundly bearded faces, each showing a broad, pleased, expectant smile beneath the mat. "Slade, Auden, Hinckley, Mole, Vaggers, Brampton, I trust I see you well." The position of the gun, its name, and something about their stance had brought the names of the ship's Sethians darting into his mind. "Very well, sir," said Slade, "which we thank you for your kindness. Only Auden here," both his neighbours pointed at him, "lost 2 toes in Tierra del Fuego, and John Brampton sinned with a woman in Tahiti and is in the sick berth yet. I grieve to hear it. I shall visit John by and by, but prosperous otherwise, I hope." "Oh, dear me, yes, sir," said Slade. "Not quite up to your Nebuchadnezzar pitch, but Seth has been very good to us." He and all his mates jerked their thumbs at what in their sect was both a holy and a lucky name. "Ha-ha!" said Jack, his mind running back to the glorious prizes they'd taken in their first cruise together. "I'm glad the Barkie's done well." They all looked affectionately over the side to where the Nutmeg, the Triton, and the two merchantmen, stuffed with wealth, were standing away to the northwest with the wind 2 points free, now more than half hull down. But you mustn't expect the Nebuchadnezzar touch again, not in these waters.
Oh, no, sir, said Slade. And all his friends went, tut, tut, tut. All we hope for to do now is to go quietly home with what we have. And if we get there,
the same simultaneous movement of six thumbs, we mean to build a tabernacle of shittin' wood for our chapel. You know our chapel, sir?
Oh, yes, indeed I do. So did anyone else coming into Shelmerston from the sea.
For although the chapel wasn't large, it was built of white marble ornamented with gilt brass S's, and it made a striking contrast with the rest of the town, mostly thatched, homely, vague in outline.
And in this here tabernacle we mean to deposit our beards as what we call a thank offering.
Very right and proper, said Jack. And having shaken hands, he moved on to Belcher, whose captain had almost certainly been both a pirate and a cannibal, and whose hand was without doubt the roughest and most vice-like in the ship.
Well, Johnson, Penderecki, John Smith and Peter Smith, said Jack.
And so along the starboard side, where only the second captains and a boarder stood by each gun, and down into the entrails of the ship. This tour resembled an inspection at divisions. But Jack wasn't accompanied by his first lieutenant, nor any of the divisional officers. It was a wholly personal affair. And although his dinner hadn't been a success, and although the soup was still with him, his face was set in pleasure as he walked through the hot and smelly gloom towards the sick berth. The ship was in high man-o'-war order. She'd lost only five hands. Three Lascars of pneumonia in the cold, wet, tedious passage of the strait, one washed out of the head by night in the heavy weather that met them as they emerged into the Pacific, and one killed when they boarded the first merchantman. And there was no doubt that under Tom Pulling she was a happy ship. Yet surely the stench was a little much, even for the orlop. Light showed under the sill of the sick berth door, and there were voices within. As he opened it, he heard with satisfaction that the two medical men were talking in Latin. The only other inhabitants were Wilkins, who had a broken arm that wouldn't knit and could not, therefore, shake hands, though grateful for the visit, and the simpler Brampton brother, the Tahiti Pox, who was too ashamed to move or speak.
"Mr. Martin," said Jack after he'd seen the invalids, "this is in no way a personal reflection on you or Captain Pullings, but is not the atmosphere down here uncommon thick, not to say unwholesome? Dr. Maturin, don't you find the atmosphere uncommon thick?"
"I do too, but I am of opinion that this is no more than the ordinary atmosphere, the ordinary fetor of an aged man of war.
For you are to consider that in foul weather, hands in the grip of peristalsis or micturition will seek some secluded corner within the ship, rather than be washed off the seat of ease out there in the open prow. So after some generations we live above a floating cesspit, the offence being aggravated by many other factors, such as the tons and tons, and advisedly do I say tons, of the vile slime that comes aboard on the cables when we've lain in a port like Batavia or Mahon, a slime made up of the filth of slaughterhouses and human habitations, to say nothing of putrid debris brought down by streams, mud and slime that drips from the cables in their tiers into the space below, which is never, never cleaned.
The Nutmeg, dear colleague," turning towards Martin, who looked somewhat out of countenance, "was as sweet as her name implies, with never a cockroach, never a mouse, still less a rat, she having lain on the seabed for months together. All her wooden members had swollen tight together, like those of a wine barrel when at last you get it tight, so that once she was pumped dry and aired within, dry she remained.
with no foul bilges swilling to and fro. And this we have been used to long enough for our noses to grow delicate. Hayes is to be hung in an airy space upstairs tomorrow, said Martin, and Brampton must finish his salivation in peace and quiet. I shall see that another wind sail's shipped, said Jack. And before he went, he leant over Brampton's cot and said, rather loud, Cheer up, Brampton. Many a man's been far worse than you, and you're in very good hands.
The woman tempted me, said Brampton, and after a short silence, I shall go to hell.
He turned his head away, his body heaving with sobs. With the captain gone, they reverted to their Latin, and Martin said, Do you think I can decently offer him comfort?
I cannot tell, said Stephen. For the moment I should exhibit a slime draught with two scruples of asafoetidum.
He turned to the medicine chest.
I see you've changed nothing, he said.
Oh, no indeed, said Martin. And then, I'm afraid the captain wasn't quite pleased.
It was only that I thoughtlessly said the ship was old, said Stephen. He cannot bear it. Having smelt the mixture, he added a little more asafoetidum and said, What induced you to say that the patient must finish his salivation in the sick berth?
Because anywhere else he'd be exposed to his shipmates' playfulness, their facetious inquiries after his membrum virili and often repeated witticisms. The Sethians are an austere set of men, and his lapses amuse the ordinary dissolute mariners. They mean no harm, but they'll play off their humours, and until he has his health, their mirth may kill him. The mind isn't very strong, and I'm afraid his friends are ill-advised to dwell so much on sin and its wages. By the time they dosed Brampton and summoned the loblolly boy to sit with the patients, no visitors to be allowed until further notice, a somewhat fresher air was wafting down the new windsail into the depths. And as they reached the quarter-deck, Jack said to Pullings, If it's kept carefully trimmed to the wind, it'll do a great deal, but, raising his voice, remarks have been passed about the charnel-house cesspit stink between decks, so perhaps we'd better open the sweetening cock.
I'm very sorry about the stench, sir. I hadn't noticed any, but then it is a little close and hot with the wind so far abaft the beam. Mr. Oakes, Mr. Reed, called Jack.
Sir, they said, pulling off their hats.
Do you know where the sweetening cock is?
They looked a little blank, and Oakes said hesitantly,
In the hold, sir? Then go to the carpenter and tell him from me that you're to be shown how to turn it on, and it's to be left on until there's 18 inches of water in the well.
When they'd gone, he turned back to Pullings and said in the same carrying tone, Of course we shall have to pump ship an hour or so longer, which is very hard in this heat, but at least it'll clean the bilges like a milkmaid's pail. This was heard by all on the quarter-deck except the medical men, who were very slowly climbing the shrouds of the mizzen-mast, concentrating too hard on their anxious task for any satirical fling to reach them. Privacy was the rarest of all the ship's amenities. Each had a cabin, but it was for solitary reading, writing, contemplation, or sleep, being as small, all proportions guarded, as a fattening coop for a single bird. And although Stephen had the run of the great cabin, the dining cabin and the sleeping cabin, which was but fair, he being the owner of the ship, none of these places was suitable for the long, detailed, and even passionate discussion of birds, beasts, and flowers, the rooms belonging equally to the captain. Nor was the gun room, with its many other inhabitants. Both would do for the occasional display of skins, bones, feathers, botanical specimens, and indeed their long tables might have been made for the purpose. But in earlier voyages they'd found that the only place for long, comfortable, uninterrupted conversation was the mizzen top, a reasonably spacious platform embracing the head of the lower mast and the foot of the one above it, poised some 40 feet above the deck, walled on either side by the topmast shrouds and their dead eyes, and aft by a little wall of canvas extended by a rail, while the front was open, giving them a good view of all the ocean that the main course and main topsail didn't shut out when the mizzen topsail wasn't set. The main top would have been higher, the foretop would have given a better view, unbeatable with the foretopsail furled, but in either case getting there was more public. Kind hands from below would place their feet on the ratlins, strong and sometimes facetious voices would call out advice. For although they made light of the peril and would even take a hand from the shroud and wave it to show how little they regarded the height, there was something about their attitude and their rate of progress which persuaded watchers that even after all these thousands of sea miles they were not seamen, nor anything even remotely resembling seamen. But the quarter-deck, from which the mizzen-top was reached, was out of bounds for three-quarters of the ship's company. Furthermore, whereas the main and foretops were often filled with busy hands, the mizzen-top was much more rarely used, particularly with the wind so far abaft the beam. Less used, but even so the relevant stunsails were kept there, folded into long, soft parcels, and upon these they reclined, gasping with their backs against the firm canvas, as they had so often sat before. "Well, there you are again," said Martin, looking at him with affectionate satisfaction. "I cannot tell you with what regret I saw you leave the ship half the world away. Apart from all other considerations, there I was with no mentor and a sick berth potentially full of diseases that I couldn't even name, far less treat. Come, you've done pretty well. No more than 3 men and 100 degrees of latitude, that's pretty well. And when all's said and done, there's little we can do in the physical line apart from bleeding, purging, sweating, and administering blue pill and even bluer ointment. Surgery is another matter. You've made the neatest job of poor West's nose. It was simplicity itself. A snip, I used scissors, a few painless stitches. And as it recovered its feeling, so it healed. Without even laudable pus. Without anything at all. It was frostbite, you know, not syphilis. So he told me. He told Captain Aubrey and me at once. I'm afraid people are tactful. Avert their eyes without any questions and look no more. I'm afraid they do. But tell me, what have you been doing all this time and what have you seen apart from the orangutan? Stephen smiled at him. And as he smiled, so the events of these past months presented themselves scarcely as a sequence, but more nearly as a whole. From them he picked what was proper to tell, together with the inward reflection, what are the 3 things that cannot be concealed? Love, sorrow, and wealth are the 3 things that cannot be concealed. And intelligence work comes very close forth. And the realization that these mental processes had occupied no more than 2 roles of the ship, magnified in space up here, but clearly not in time. "You must know," said he, "that Captain Aubrey was called back to England to be fully reinstated and to take command of the Diane. She was to carry an envoy to the Sultan of Pulo Prabang, who was contemplating an alliance with the French. And since this island..." "Oh, such orchids and coleoptera, Martin, apart from my celestial ape and the unimaginably huge rhinoceros, lies in the South China Sea, almost across the path of our Indiaman coming from Canton. And where should we be without our rhubarb and tea, God preserve us? The envoy's mission was to induce the Sultan to change his mind. It was thought useful that I should go too, speaking French and having some knowledge of Malay as well as medicine. And so we went, sailing as fast as ever we could, making our only stop at Tristan da Cunha. But that was very nearly our last. The ship being heaved nearer and nearer and nearer, a sheer wall of rock by rollers topmast high, and never a breath of wind to give us motion. I assure you, however, we survived it, and I even set foot on Tristan, flattering myself I should see wonders while they were watering and taking in green stuff. It will not surprise you to learn that I was snatched away within hours, on the plea that they mustn't lose some favourable conjuncture of wind, tide, or the like. Then the far southern ocean, and there at last I had albatrosses, giant petrels, stink pots, pintados, but at such a cost. Monstrous billows, an incessant shrieking wind that allowed human thought and speech only when we were in the vast deep hollow of the wave, and then ice, ice on the deck, ice on the ropes, ice mountains in the sea of most prodigious size, and I must confess prodigious beauty, that threatened to do us in, as the seamen say. So Captain Aubrey directed our course to more Christian seas, and I was in great hopes of seeing Amsterdam Island, a remote and uninhabited speck untouched by any naturalist, its flora, fauna and geology wholly undescribed. I saw it, indeed, but only far to windward, and the ship carried on under a press of sail for Java Head. The sun had set in its usual abrupt tropical manner soon after they'd made themselves comfortable. Night had swept over the sky, showing the eastern stars after the few minutes of twilight, and now on the larboard beam a glowing planet heaved up on the horizon, lying there for a moment like the stern lantern of some important ship. Martin was a man of peace. Maturin, with certain qualifications, was in principle opposed to violence. Yet both had absorbed so much of the man-of-war's, and even more, the letter of Marx's predatory values, that they fell silent, staring like tigers at the planet until it rose clear of the sea and betrayed its merely celestial character. I must ask Captain Aubrey the name of that prodigious star, said Stephen. He's sure to know. And as it were in answer to these words, they heard Jack tuning his violin far below. I should pass over Java on the great kindness of Governor Raffles, a most distinguished naturalist for the now, though I shall show you some of my specimens when we can find a table free. Did you know there was a Java peacock? God help me, I never did. A famous proud bird he is, too. And I shall only observe that we reached Pulo Prabang, that our envoy outwitted the French, although they were there before us, and that he induced the Sultan to sign a treaty of alliance with Great Britain. Happily, all this took some time, would that it had been longer by far, in which I had the inestimable good fortune of becoming acquainted with Dr. Van Buren, of whom you may have heard. The great Dutch authority on the spleen, the same, but his interests spread far beyond. To the pancreas, the thyroid, even farther. There is nothing in the animal or vegetable kingdoms that doesn't arouse his eager, deeply informed curiosity. It was to him that I owed my introduction to an inconceivably remote paradise inhabited by Buddhist monks, where the birds and beasts have no fear of men, have never been harmed, and where I walked hand in hand with an amiable, aged female orangutan. Oh, Maturin! And other wonders that I have noted down. But if I should tell you a half of them and show you the half of my specimens with remarks, we should still be talking when we reach New South Wales, and I haven't yet heard a word from you. Let me just close my summary by telling you that we sailed off in triumph with our treaty, that we cruised at one of the points of rendezvous without success, and that in the course of our return to Batavia, the Diane struck an uncharted reef. There are many in that uncomfortable sea, it appears. Ran onto it by night, and at the very height of flood, we couldn't pull her off. But there being an island fairly close at hand, we carried most of our possessions to it in rowing boats, formed a military camp, and sat down, tolerably easy in our minds, to wait for the next spring tide, which, as you probably know, depends on the moon. But we were tolerably easy because our wells supplied us with water and the woods with boar. While the island was not without interest, being inhabited by ring-tailed apes, two sorts of pig,
Suspavorusa and Barbatus, and numerous colonies of the so-called bird's nest soup swallow, which I'm sorry to say isn't a swallow at all, but only a dwarvish species of oriental swift. The envoy, however, didn't wait for us to settle. He was eager to return with his treaty, and Captain Aubrey gave him the new launch with adequate stores and crew for the voyage to Batavia, a voyage of no more than 200 miles that would have been no great matter but for a typhoon that destroyed our ship on its reef and certainly overwhelmed the open boat. We were building a schooner from the wreckage when a horde of ill-favoured Rapparees attacked us, Dyaks and Malays, led by a nasty, confident Queen, a bloody-minded, covetous Froan strumpet. They killed many of our people, but we killed more of theirs. They burnt our schooner, the thieves, as they left, but we destroyed their prower entirely with one brilliant ball from the captain's long nine. Then it was an anxious time with the boar so thin on the ground and barely a ring-tailed ape at all. But, however, a junk that put in for birds' nests carried us back to Batavia, where Governor Raffles gave us that charming ship, the Nutmeg, in which you found us. There. Those are the essentials, which I hope to fill with notes and specimens as we sail along. Now, pray tell me what you have done and what you've seen. Well, said Martin, although I've not seen an orangutan, my journey hasn't been without its interesting moments. You may recall that last time we had the happiness of walking in the Brazilian forest, I was bitten by an owl-faced night ape. Certainly I do. How you bled. This time I was bitten by a tapir, and bled even more. A tapir, for our love. A young striped and spotted tapir, Tapirus americanus. I saw his huge, dark brown, distracted mother at the turn of a little sort of track or path by the river. She rushed wildly into the water below and was seen no more. I found that he was caught in a pitfall, and when with infinite pains I had seized him and hoisted him to the edge, he bit me. If there were any light, I should show you the scar. And before I could get out of the pit, a band of Indians came up, no doubt those that had dug it, and they reproached me very bitterly, stabbing the air with their spears. I was exceedingly uneasy, so uneasy that I hardly felt the pain. But happily a party from the ship appeared, and one of the seamen who spoke Portuguese gave them a piece of tobacco and desired them to go about their business. But it comes to me that one of the party was Wilkins, whose broken arm you saw in the sick berth. May I break off for a moment and ask what you thought of him? Right, that seemed to me an ordinary distal radius ulna transverse fracture with some lateral displacement effectively reduced. The kind of break you'd expect from a fall. But as it was dressed according to the Basserat method, I didn't see much of the arm. When did it take place? 3 weeks ago, and it's not yet knit, nor beginning to knit. The ends are closely approximated as crepitus, but there's no union. You suspect scurvy, I collect. Sure, that is a usual sign, though by no means infallible. And incipient scurvy would in part account for John Brampton's extreme lowness of spirits. Are we out of juice? No. But I opened a new keg no great while ago, and I doubt its quality. We bought it in Buenos Aires. I have a net of fresh lemons and an elegant private keg, wholly reliable, which will do for some months. But as Captain Aubrey doesn't intend to touch at New Guinea, and as the voyage is long, we may ask him to steer in time for a convenient, well-charted, well-stocked island. 8 bells below them, and the watch was mustered. Loud, unmistakable calls, hoots and pipes. Lord, said Stephen, I should be late again. Will you sup with us? Thank you, you're very good, but I must beg to be excused this time, said Martin, looking through the lubber's hole with some anxiety. We shall have to climb down in the dark. So we must, said Stephen. If it were not for my engagement, I should soon have stayed up here, so soft and gentle a night, with no fear of the moon, Paul, or of falling damps. If we had a little dark lantern, we could see better, said Martin. Truer word was never spoke, said Stephen. I don't like to call for one, however. It might
seem unseemanlike. It was this very top Wilkins fell from when he broke his arm. It's true he was drunk at the time, but the height is much the same. Come, let us show more than Roman fortitude, said Stephen. Gravity will help us, and perhaps St. Brendan. He let himself down through the hole, his feet groping for the ratlins, very narrow, up here where the shrouds were crowded in so close. His toe found one far, far down, and he let go the rim. But he did so without considering that he should have waited for the roll to swing him in towards the mast. For a moment as disagreeable as any, his hands clawed the empty darkness. They did, in fact, seize a shroud, the aftermost of all, for he hadn't waited for the pitch either. He clung there long enough to be able to answer with an even voice when Martin, who, being on the other side, had profited by the roll, asked him how he did.
Perfectly well, I thank you.
Forgive me if I'm a little late, he said, walking into the smell of toasted cheese. I'm just come from the mizzen-top.
Not at all, said Jack. As you see, I've not waited for you. I was in the mizzen-top from before sunset until a couple of minutes ago.
Yes, said Jack. Should you like some wine, or shall you wait for the punch?
Considering my excesses at dinner and the state of the wine in this climate, I believe I shall confine myself to punch. To a very moderate dose of punch. What an elegant toasted cheese dish. Have I seen it before?
No, this is the first time it's been out of its box. I'd ordered it from the man in Dublin you recommended, and I picked it up when we were last at the cottage. Then I forgot all about it.
Stephen lifted the lid, and there were several dishes, sizzling gently over a spirit lamp under the outer shell, the whole gleaming from Killick's devoted hand. He turned it this way and that, admiring the workmanship, and said,
"It's the long road you've come, Jack, that you can forget 100 guineas or so."
"Oh, yes," said Jack. "Lord, we were so miserably poor. I remember how you came back to that house in Hampstead with a fine beefsteak wrapped in a cabbage leaf. And how happy we were."
They talked of their poverty, bailiffs, arrest for debt, sponging houses, fears of more arrests, various expedients. But presently, when these considerations of wealth and poverty, the wheel of fortune and so on, had been dealt with, the zest and cheerfulness went out of the conversation. And after his second dish of cheese, Stephen became aware of a certain constraint in his friend. The frank, hearty laugh was heard no more. Jack's eyes were directed more at the massive gun that shared the cabin with them than at Stephen's face. Silence fell, as much silence as could fall in a ship making 8 knots, with the water singing along her hull, her troubled wake streaming, and all her standing and running rigging together with its countless blocks uttering their particular notes in a general volume of sound. Out of this silence, Jack said, "I went round the ship this afternoon to ask our shipmates how they did. And I noticed that they were many of them older than when I saw them last. That made me think perhaps I was older too. And when you spoke of the barkey as an aged man of war, it quite put me about. And yet it was absurd in me to toss all these together in one gloomy pot, for although the Sethians may have grown beards a yard long, and although no doubt I ought to wear lean and slippery pantaloons, a ship and a man are different things. Was that right, brother?"
"Yes, it is. You may not think so, but they are quite different. The Surprise isn't old. Look at Victory. She's tolerably spry, I believe. Nobody would call her old, I believe. But she was built years before the Surprise. Look at the Royal William. You know the William, Stephen. I've pointed her out many and many a time among the hulks at Pompey. A first rate of 110 guns. Sure, I remember a dreadful-looking object. That's only because of the uses she's been put to. It's her heart and life I'm talking about. Her timbers are as sound as the day she was built, or sounder. You run your knife into one of her knees and it'll bend or break in your goddamn hand. And I saw a length of one of her shrouds when the worming and service were taken off. Perfectly sound, too. White, untarred cordage and perfectly sound. And the Royal William was laid down in 1676. 1676! No. No. Perhaps the surprise is not one of your gimcrack modern craft, flung together with unseasoned timber by contract in some hole in the corner yard. She may have been built some time ago, but she's not old. And you know, who better, the improvements that have been carried out. Diagonal bracing, reinforced knees, sheathing. You speak quite passionately, my dear. Protectively, as if I'd said something disagreeable about your wife. That's because I do, in fact, feel passionate and protective. I've known this ship so many years, man and boy, that I don't like to hear her blackguarded. Jack, when I said aged, I referred only to the generations or ages of filth that have accumulated below. I didn't mean to blackguard her any more than I should blackguard dear Sophie, God forbid. Well, said Jack, I'm sorry I flew out. I'm sorry I spoke so chuff. My tongue took the bit between its teeth, so I was laid by the lee again, which is very absurd because I'd meant to be particularly winning and agreeable. I'd meant to say that, yes, there was 100 tons of shingle ballast down there that should have been changed long ago. And after having admitted so much and said that we intended to open the sweetening cock and pump her cleaner, I was to go on and ask whether you would consider selling her to me. It would give me so much pleasure. Stephen was chewing a large, rebellious piece of cheese. As it went down at last, he said indistinctly, "Very well, Jack." And covertly looking at the decently restrained delight on his friend's face, he wondered how, physically speaking, do his eyes assume this much intenser blue? They shook hands on it, and Jack said, "We've not talked about her price. Do you choose to name it now, or had you rather reflect?" "You shall give me what I gave," said Stephen. "How much it was, I don't at present recall, but Tom Pullings will tell us. He bid for me." Jack nodded. "We'll ask him in the morning. He's dead beat now." And raising his voice, "Killick!" "Sir," answered Killick, appearing within the second. "Bring the doctor the best punch bowl and everything necessary, then clear away his cello and my fiddle in the great cabin and place the music stands." "Punch bowl it is, sir, and the kettle's already on the boil," said Killick, almost laughing as he spoke. "And Killick," said Stephen, "instead of the lemons, pray bring up the smaller keg from my cabin. You may take it from its sailcloth jacket." The bowl appeared, together with its handsome ladle. Then a long pause before Killick could be heard stamping along the half-deck. From the peevish oaths, it was clear that one of his mates was giving him a hand, but he came in alone, clasping the keg to his belly. "Put it on the locker, Killick," said Stephen. "Which I never knew you had it," said Killick, with an odd mixture of admiration and resentment as he stood away from the barrel, oak with polished copper bands, and on its head the stamp Bronte XXX, with an engraved plate below, "To that eminent physician, Dr. Stephen Maturin, whose abilities are surpassed only by the gratitude of those who have benefited from them, Clarence." "Bronte!" cried Jack. "Can it be?" "It can indeed. This is triple refined Sicilian juice from his own estate, a present from Prince William. I meant to keep it for Trafalgar Day, but seeing this is a special occasion, perhaps we may draw off an ounce or so and drink the immortal memory tonight." The steaming bowl, the melted sugar, the heady smell of arrack,
and as Stephen stirred in his concentrated lemon juice, he said, "I must tell you that there may possibly be some hint of scurvy aboard your ship. It was Martin that noticed it first, to my shame, the valuable man. Certainly all hands say how lucky we are to have him. He suggested, and I heartily concur, that we should steer for some fruitful island. There's no urgent necessity with what I have brought with me, but from the medical point of view, we should certainly have a relief at some halfway stage, if ever you can find one in the limitless ocean."